knew we'd have the elite group today because it's Canoga weekend, and which was kind of a problem because we were trying to pick which speaker to do which week, and we hated for anyone to miss any of them. And Michelle Alexander was like, oh, how can we? And, but then the Ark of the, but yeah, so, you know, they're all terrific. And actually, I've got something to show you about that. I don't know who was not here last Saturday. Sunday. Everybody was here last week? Because I don't want to, I don't want to take up your time explaining again what Trinity Institute is if you already saw it, is why I ask. But if people didn't know, I was eager for them to know. One question that came up during the week was, how can I find these wonderful things from myself? So I made you a little slide saying that here's the web address, but that you don't have to have a photographic memory for this. You can just search Trinity Institute 2018 and it'll pop right up. The page will look like this, and there's a where it says registered partners access, click here, and the password is values 18, all caps. So you can actually skip ahead and see the other things. But what we hope you'll want to do is see the whole talks by the folks you've already seen. You can see the whole sermon from the bishop. You'll be able to see all of the piece that we're going to see about 15 minutes of today. So that's how you can find this for yourself. Once you become a partner to this, you have access to their video library. So there's wonderful things and materials up there for us. So this week we've got author and lawyer Michelle Alexander talking. Last week we were on story that around our own lives and our own families, to follow up on the bishop urging us to think about other people as being our sisters and brothers, and how we could take our family stories and do something with that. This week we've got what really sprang to our attention on all of us on the committee out of Michelle Alexander's talk was her saying something that people often maybe don't admit to, which is that she's changed over time, that her thinking has really evolved. People like to get up in front of other people and go, oh, I am an expert, and I came out of the egg an expert, and, you know, look at me. And she gets right up there and admits that things that have happened in her life have affected her thinking and changed how she does things. And she says these things right up front. So that's the little section we'll hear from her today. We're going to start with Trinity Institute's introduction of her, so you don't have to listen to me explain who she is and why they were. I mean, you should have seen the audience on when you watch the whole thing. They're like, oh my God, they got Michelle Alexander. So you'll see why they're so excited to have her as a speaker, and then we'll hear from her for about 10 minutes.
And now I invite you to turn your attention to the screens.
Michelle Alexander is an attorney, a legal scholar, a civil rights advocate, and author of the 2010 best-selling and groundbreaking book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Alexander received her undergraduate degree from Vanderbilt University, followed by law school at Stanford, where she graduated in the class of 1992. She spent several years as director of the Racial Justice Project at the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California, which spearheaded a national campaign against racial profiling by law enforcement. Alexander also served as law clerk for Justice Harry Blackmun at the U.S. Supreme Court and for Chief Judge Abner Mikva on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. She then spent more than a decade on the faculty at the Law School of The Ohio State University. Michelle Alexander is now a faculty member at Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York as visiting professor of social justice.
Please join me in welcoming Michelle Alexander. Now, Now, don't take up too much of her time. We've been trying to get Michelle here for some time, and I'm really delighted that it's worked out for this. This is the right time.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, your book, The New Jim Crow, which we study here, asks important questions about who we are and who we want to be. And people often use the word values to talk about such things. I'm not sure we often stop and define the word values. What does that word mean for you?
Well, I guess I would say values are one's fundamental, reflect one's fundamental belief structure. What you truly believe, the core principles and ideas that animate your life, what you're willing to stand for, what you're willing to sacrifice for, those core ideas and beliefs that define not just what we say but what we do, I think, are our true values.
Are there particular values that have led you into the work that you do?
Yeah, you know, I think that there was a time when I was younger, well, actually probably as recently as 10 years ago, that I would have said my core values are freedom and justice and equality, and that those are the values that kind of drive my work and my sense of mission and purpose in the world. But that's really changed. Over time, in some ways. I mean, it's not that I no longer value those things. I absolutely do. But I would now say that if I were to define my core values, I would say I believe that each and every one of us, no matter who we are, where we came from, or what we may have done, is worthy of care, compassion, and concern. And for me, that feels different than simply demanding justice or demanding freedom or demanding equality. It brings the focus on how we individually and collectively respond to every human being. Are we willing to respond with genuine care, compassion, and concern, no matter who they are, where they came from, or what they may have done? You know, Dr. Cornel West says that justice is what love looks like in public. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, that if we've put our focus first on the level of care we are willing to show every human being, no matter whether you have murdered someone or whether you've just lost your son to a horrendous crime, that each one of those people, the murderer and those who are suffering as victims, are equally worthy of care, compassion, and concern. For me, that revolutionizes the way we think about justice, what we mean by equality, and what freedom looks like.
It sounds like it's moved from something you can define externally to something that's internal. It's still focused on the whole of the community, but it starts with our own caring.
Yeah, I think for me, it's partly shifting from kind of an allegiance to abstract ideals to bringing it home and making it very personal in terms of how we live our life and how we relate to those who are in our communities and outside of them. I think I have to credit Dr. Vincent Harding for my own transition along these lines. You know, not long after my book came out, I was, you know, speaking to anybody who would listen. I mean, I was just on the road day in and day out telling the story of mass incarceration in the United States, trying to sound the alarm, trying to wake people up to the human rights nightmare that is occurring on our watch. And I would share the facts and the figures and the data. I wanted people to know we had quintupled our prison population for reasons that had stunningly little to do with crime and crime rates, that more African Americans are under correctional control today than were enslaved in 1850, that Millions of people were now stripped of basic civil and human rights, and this was not simply because millions of poor people and people of color had just suddenly decided they wanted to be criminals, but rather there was economic collapse in poor communities of color, and that we responded by ending a war on poverty and declaring a war on drugs. And I just went from city to city, speaking in churches and universities, and Dr. Vincent Harding invited me to come speak at the Iliff School of Theology. And for those of you who may not be familiar with Vincent Harding's work, he was a close friend and advisor to Martin Luther King Jr. He drafted his Beyond Vietnam speech that was delivered at Riverside Church. He wrote wonderful books. I didn't know much about him, actually, when he invited me to speak. And I came and gave, really, one of my standard new Jim Crow lectures. And when I gave it, I was haunted by this voice that I had been hearing in my head that was really unnerving to me. I had been going everywhere trying to deliver this message that I was passionate about. And as I would get ready to walk off the stage, this voice kept haunting me that said, "All sound and fury and signifying nothing." And it was really tearing me apart because I had poured everything I had in writing the book. I had young children at home that were being left behind as I was on the road. And this voice, "All sound and fury signifying nothing," was just haunting me, and I did not understand, like, why? Why was I haunted by this feeling? And after I gave my new Jim Crow speech at Iliff and came off the stage, Vincent came up to me and very tenderly took my hand and said, "I need to talk to you, sister. Come sit down." And he said, "I hear what you're saying, and I'm so grateful for the work that you're doing in the world, and I've read your book." He said, "But I think there's a deeper message that you're trying to communicate here. There's something deeper that you're trying to say." And then in his typical fashion, he lowered his voice and spoke very slowly, and he said, "What you're really trying to say is what you do unto the least of these, my brethren, you do unto me." It's like, that's the message. That's the truth. That's what your work is all about. And it was just like something just cracked wide open in me, where I realized that this wasn't simply about unfair sentencing or mandatory minimums or racial disparities, that there is a far deeper truth that lie at the core of all of this. And it was our inability or our refusal to see the dignity and divinity within each and every one of us that lie at the core, not only of the system of mass incarceration, but every system of racial and social control that has ever existed in America, and every form of oppression that has ever existed in the world, is this idea of the basic inferiority and denial of the dignity and divinity of each and every one of us.
And it's so powerful that Vincent Harding sort of listened you into a deeper sense of what your vocation already was. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I know you're doing a series of public conversations at Union, mm-hmm. Which are available online and are wonderful, important to listen to. We invited you to give a talk to this conference. You said, "Could we do a conversation?" Mm-hmm. So I'd like to ask you, is conversation itself a value for you?
Yeah, it has become one. And I also want to credit Vincent in some respects for this because, Vincent was fiercely committed to dialogues and to public dialogues, private dialogues, to conversation. And he believed that we needed to learn how to talk to one another about race, about our racial history, about trauma, that we needed to learn how to have conversations, and that we couldn't just preach at one another and lecture one another. And that really resonated for me because I'd been doing a lot of speechifying. and I realized that when I opened myself up to conversation, that I realized that the questions people had didn't always match up with the information I was trying to share. Mm-hmm. And so rather than just going from place to place telling people what I thought they ought to know, that perhaps I should open myself up first to hearing what questions that they may have. And so I find now that my conversations are very different in place to place, that I'm not saying the same thing over and over again. I still hope that people care about the data and the history and the facts and will read my book and others. But I also want to honor the importance of having conversations, of modeling conversations, and encouraging others to do so as well.
Would you share with us some of what you've learned about that? Specifically, when people experience themselves as polarized, or this person is very different from me, how do you have a conversation? Or when you want to be sure there's really agency on both sides of the conversation, what have you learned about how to do that?
Well, I think for me, in my experience, the most important thing is not imagining that you're entering this conversation in order to convince the other person that they're wrong and that you're right. Having some humility in the conversation and acknowledging the ways in which you are wrong and have been wrong and are still learning, I think, are incredibly important. You know, I began my own book by acknowledging that I didn't always think the way that I do now. And, you know, when I was working as a civil rights lawyer, I made some horrible mistakes. In fact, the book is inspired in many ways by an experience I had with a young man who asked me to represent him. He was a victim of racial profiling, and he came to me and told me his story and asked me to represent him, and I didn't believe him. I didn't believe the story that he had to tell. When he told me that he had been convicted of a drug felony, I told him that we couldn't possibly represent him because of his felony record in a racial profiling class action suit, and gave him a long list of reasons about why that was a case. Well, the case at that time, we were refusing to represent all people with felony records and racial profiling litigation because we knew that if we did, law enforcement and the media would be all over us saying, well, of course, the police are all over him. He's a felon, he's a criminal, you know, that's us going after the bad guys. I had refused to represent him because of his felony record. I had disbelieved the story he had told me about the police. He had told me that the police had planted drugs on him and framed him and his friend, and that the police had beat him up. And it's a long story. I'd refused to represent him. He became enraged when I told him that I wouldn't, and he said, you know, you're no better than the police. You know, I can't believe I trusted you. He said, what's to become of my life? Do you know, because I'm a felon, I can't get a job anywhere. I can't even get access to public housing. Where am I supposed to sleep? I can't even get food stamps. How am I supposed to live? And he stormed out of my office saying, I can't believe I trusted you. You're no better than the police. And several months later, I came to realize he had been telling me the truth. On the front page of the newspaper was a story about the Oakland Riders, a gang of police officers, otherwise known as a drug task force, that had been planting drugs on suspects and beating folks up, and who was named as one of the main officers accused of planting drugs on suspects and beating folks up? The person he had identified to me as having planted drugs on him and beat him and his friend up. And you know, it was only then that the light finally started to come on for me, and I realized I'm no better than the police. The minute he told me he was a felon, I stopped listening to him. I couldn't hear what he had to say. I myself, as a civil rights lawyer who is dedicated to racial justice, I was replicating the very forms of discrimination and exclusion I supposedly thought I was, you know, fighting against. That was the beginning of my journey, waking up. And so I can't go into a conversation with someone chastising them for their attitudes about felons or you know, imagining that the young kid on the street corner with his pants sagging or whatever is, you know, nothing better than a thug that shouldn't be taken seriously or shouldn't, you know, be listened to, when I've been guilty of that myself. And
You can see why we thought that was such a powerful way to get this, to connect to what we heard last week from the bishop, who also referenced the whatever you've done to the least of these story that she references as well, and her emphasis on what we're going to learn from conversation with each other instead of just thinking we can make the other person have our values. And we also really admired, you know, the bravery of a public expert saying, I've been wrong about things, and I was really seriously wrong about things, and how instead of making that her look weak, it makes her stronger, because she's able to, instead of just preach at you, go, I was, you know, I understand where you are because I've been there too. Come with me to, you know, listen, let me listen to you, and maybe we can come along together. So we thought all that was very admirable and connected in with the larger theme of the class about learning through story, and also connecting back to the last kind of story emphasis on the in the rector's forum. So we have got for you, as we did last week, some things to talk about in a group. Let's see if we can, look at that. We're gonna pop up there for us. Yay. Can we have the lights? That would be great. We're done. I mean, this is gonna stay up here, but we're now gonna talk, so we can use these lights back on now. Thanks. This week, we thought that all of us had a very similar experience to what Michelle Alexander describes of having our thinking evolved, and that's such a valuable thing to reflect on. So let's chat with each other a little bit about, maybe tell some stories about how our own thinking has evolved over time. You know, what's something you used to think or believe but now don't? Could be something silly. I can sure think of a lot of just ridiculous things that I just really thought were true. What changed your mind about it? Or maybe something that someone told you when you were young that turned out not to be true. How did you find out about that? What used to be important to you but isn't anymore? Maybe the other way around. How have things changed over time for you and your beliefs and values? And then after maybe talking about that for a little bit, we could reflect on, now, maybe there are some different things that we're fairly confident, since I thought we might all be kind of a mature group here, that we might now be at a kind of looking back point of things that we are fairly confident about, that we think are useful truths or guiding principles. And how would other people know that about us if they were looking at us? Maybe we could think of that as a more action thing, not I know this about people, or I believe this is important, but more of a, you know, I do or say these things because I now believe these things, because we do want to keep that kind of action quality to it, rather than I have these values, it's I do these things because of my values. Maybe we can think of some stuff, build up to being able to think about some stuff like that. We don't have tables this week, but we think that we're all grown-ups and don't have too much trouble flipping some chairs around. And so maybe we could make, about three groups might be about the right size, and maybe some of the committee members can help that happen. We've got about 15 to 20 minutes to talk a little bit about this. Also, if you're excited about Michelle Alexander, if you go out that door and do a U-turn, literally the first thing you'll see on the bookshelves in the library is a row of books that includes the new Jim Crow.